And welcome to Outlaw, a podcast about how the law is used to repress social movements in the U.S. Today I'm talking to Christian and Garrett about the policing strategies used against movements in the U.S. and how understanding them over time can help us make sense of how to respond in this moment. Christian Williams is the author of Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America. He's an anarchist historian who has studied the different strategies U.S. police use to prevent social change. And Garrett is an anarchist, anti-repression activist, and legal worker who himself experienced repression as one of the RNC aide. As always, this podcast is not advocating for any particular kind of action, and it is not legal advice, and some guests' views may differ from our own. Stick around after the interview to hear a poem by political prisoner Malik Muhammad. The roots, the trunks, and the leaves. When a tree falls down, not a soul is around, does it make a sound? Christian and Garrett, welcome to Outlaw. Can you introduce yourselves and your research on or experience with counterinsurgency policing?
My name is Garrett. I use he, him pronouns. I'm an anarchist activist, legal worker, and anti-repression activist here in Minneapolis. And so I engage with sort of the ideas around counterinsurgency policing, you know, often when I'm talking to folks about how repression happens, what types of repression they might expect if they're engaging in movement work, and yeah, how to understand the ideas of repression resilience in the context of counterinsurgency.
Hello, yes, I'm Christian Williams. I'm the author of Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, which is a history of policing in the United States. And a few years after that, I edited one of three editors on a book called Life During Wartime about counterinsurgency and social movements. In Our Enemies in Blue, I made the, at the time, audacious claim that looking at the overlap between the militarization of the police and community policing, especially since the 1960s, that the two of those together represented a domestic application of counterinsurgency warfare. Since I first wrote that in 2004, there's been a lot of out in the open discussion of that, especially in military circles. So I feel like what was once a crackpot claim has instead been vindicated by the authorities.
So when we say counterinsurgency policing, what do we mean by that? And how does it relate to other aspects of state repression, white supremacy more broadly? And why is it important for movements to understand today?
So it's important to understand that counterinsurgency isn't simply synonymous with repression. It's a particular approach to repression, and it's a particular theory of it. And it really, its emergence first in the efforts of colonial authorities to resist national liberation struggles. It originated there, and it was based on this realization that the inequality of society was going to inevitably produce certain kinds of conflict. And so it was a move away from an earlier conspiratorial model that saw all resistance, all uprisings, all that sort of thing, as the result of sort of outside forces infiltrating a population and manipulating it, and instead looked at the dynamics internal to the society that would produce resistance and produce rebellion among the population, and then try to address the root causes of that. And it really emphasized two aspects, one being what we typically think of as repression, like identifying movement leaders and taking steps to neutralize them, disrupting networks among the insurgents, that sort of thing. But even more important were the efforts necessary for the authorities to establish their legitimacy. And that meant offering certain measures of concessions to the population, creating a sense of the stability and an appearance of justice in the society, and really building popular support for the existing power structure. The degree to which this is successful is debatable, but yeah, and it's gone in and out of fashion in military circles. It was, you know, popular in the United States during the Vietnam War. It was sort of the going theory, and then after the defeat in Vietnam, the U.S. military largely gave up on it until the occupation of Iraq, where it had to scramble to relearn the lessons of counterinsurgency. Interestingly, when it was faced with that, the place where it looked was U.S. police departments. Prior to about the 1960s, the police took an approach to responding to social movements, which was almost entirely just repressive. That it was, you know, first of all, viewed social movements as kind of conspiracy and saw their job as identifying and neutralizing the conspirators. And then also just, you know, took the approach of clubs and dogs and fire hoses against people who were demonstrating. And this had the paradoxical effect of really feeding the rebellion, because the more the police applied force, the more unjust the inequalities of society appeared. And so it would shift sympathy away from, it would undercut the legitimacy of the government and build sympathy for, you know, for example, the civil rights movement, before that, labor movement, et cetera. Beginning in the 60s, the police realized that they couldn't just rely on brute force to preserve the status quo, and instead needed to engage in projects to build up specifically their own legitimacy. And the move toward community policing, which was really this effort for more community engagement, for the police to be more responsive to the community, but also for the police to enter into kinds of partnerships with community leaders as a way of advancing their own agenda, that really emerged out of this period. Interestingly, those efforts occurred simultaneously and often in the same places and often led by the same people as the increased militarization of the police, where we saw, you know, the emergence of the SWAT team, the increased use of automatic rifles, the deployment of police with ballistic vests, that sort of thing. Equally importantly, the reorganization of police departments into sort of platoons and like really more of a military structure, as opposed to the more straightforwardly bureaucratic structure that they had had before. So what we've seen then is that rather than there being a hard option and a soft option, and a police department's faced with a choice between these approaches, their militarization and community policing are actually complementary aspects to a single strategy, which amounts to counterinsurgency.
So just to jump in a little bit in some of that. So when I talk about repression, I often define it actually by one of your co-editors defined it as all the means that sort of the state and reactionary forces use to protect themselves from change. And so obviously there's not complete overlap in the Venn diagram between what is repression and counterinsurgency. And in fact, I think a lot of the way counterinsurgency behaves has more to do with oppression and just how society is laid out and structured as a whole and who is given power and who is held down, but that repression is all of those means. So when Christian talks about repression being clubs and dogs and whatnot, I also just want to be clear that in my mind and in the trainings that I do, you know, media, informants, co-option, all of those things are a part of repression. They're part of the apparatus of what the state uses to protect itself from change. And actually, in quoting Life During Wartime here, one of the articles, I think Lutzo, Lane, and Sarah, our comrades, say, counterinsurgency can be the cops kicking down your door, but it can also be the co-option of community organizing, the increasing capacity for sophisticated data collection, the mapping of social networks, and the paid informant sitting quietly through the meetings. So just that we understand that there's the hard policing and the soft policing, you know, and maybe it's not a binary, it's a spectrum, are all a part of maintaining the status quo and all a part of repressing social movements. And that if police are like excited to work with you and cooperate with you and collaborate with you, you should be wary that, you know, their soft touch is not about helping you be more effective, especially if you have revolutionary goals.
A metaphor that the cops themselves use about this is an iron fist in a velvet glove. And the thing that gives the velvet glove its shape is the iron fist inside of it.
How have models of counterinsurgency, policing, and repression more broadly shifted in recent years and into the current administration?
In my experience, you know, one of the biggest shifts and the way that that strategy plays out that you like, you know, can see it right in front of you is who are in the past 20 years who have been the primary targets of repression in movements. And what we see is a move from kind of the new left era, where you're seeing assassinations of movement leaders, jailing of movement leaders. You know, we think about all of those revolutionaries from the new left, Fred Hampton, you know, Leonard Peltier, all these folks who, you know, faced pretty serious repression in large part because of their leadership. And then you look over the past 20 years and it tends to be more the person that's entrapped for a Molotov cocktail, for having Molotov cocktails, or a big like mass arrest or Ketamine and things like that, that actually the moments where people that have kind of had a sort of been in sort of like a powerful or more leadership like position in movements get targeted are way fewer and farther between. So it's the law enforcement working on the edges to try to shape the container of our organizing and, you know, maintain its own legitimacy and make people afraid to want to be a part of these movements. You know, if they just go after the leaders, then you can be a rank and file member of a movement and you don't have to worry about facing repression. But that's not what we see. And I would say especially that would be true over the past 25 years with what we see in like grand jury, a lot of like grand jury resistance stuff, with, I mean, some notable exceptions, that when they go on their fishing expedition, they're, you know, trying to find people that are more easily isolated. And it fits into this legitimacy narrative because oftentimes they're looking at people who within the movement that they're a part of maybe took the edgier or more extreme action. So, you know, the people during the uprising here in Minneapolis that got charged with aiding and abetting arson, well, they're easier to criminalize. They're going to have fewer people standing behind them saying, oh yeah, it's great to go commit arson. And therefore they're kind of like increasing their own legitimacy by saying, okay, well, we're not going after the people who talked about radical change to policing. We're going after the quote unquote, like actual criminals. That plays into this, like, ultimately it being a struggle for legitimacy, a legitimate power, and, you know, the arbiter of what is okay and what isn't okay.
The one caveat I would bring up is that I think counterinsurgency is going rapidly out of fashion. I think we see that shifting back. And so this is, in a way, not surprising, because part of what counterinsurgency was getting away from was sort of J. Edgar Hoover style conspiracy theories, which were always looking for like the Soviet agents that were secretly manipulating the civil rights movement or whatever. And, you know, I don't want to put too much on the personality of a single person, but, you know, Donald Trump entered politics pushing the conspiracy theory about Obama's birth certificate. And he has a very conspiratorial mind frame and tends to surround himself with people who are equally conspiracy minded. And so in Portland, where I live, during the 2020 uprising, the leadership of the Department of Homeland Security was very insistent on finding the mastermind of the, and they genuinely seemed to think that there was going to be like a person who was going to be identified who was behind the uprising here, you know, the Antifa infiltrators into the demonstration. And even as their own intelligence analysts were saying, yeah, there's actually no evidence of a conspiracy, the leadership was insistent that there was. And to some degree, that hobbled their own intelligence efforts. And more recently, in the new Trump term, we're seeing an approach to repression that looks less like counterinsurgency and a lot more like McCarthyism, where they're very actively policing, you know, literally just speech, and looking for people who are, you know, disloyal in some respect. And I mean, in a way, it's worse than McCarthyism, because for McCarthy, it was the idea that you're disloyal to the United States, whatever that meant. And for Trump, it's really you're disloyal to him personally. And again, as I mentioned, counterinsurgency has gone in and out of fashion in different institutions. And I think we're seeing a deliberate move away from that sort of sociological understanding of resistance and repression, and more an assertion of the conspiratorial model, which is going to open up some important chasms within the government of agencies or individuals who view this in different ways, which ideally presents an opportunity for increasing those fissures, although right now it's hard to know how to exploit those. Garrett, I'd love to hear what you think about that.
I mean, I think that's right on. I think I've been having a lot of conversations with folks about that recently, and it's creating a lot of anxiety, actually, in this moment as people, you know, with Trump sort of like flood the zone approach and the sort of unpredictability that is his hallmark, this sort of question of, oh, well, this is how repression generally works, and this is sort of the response you can expect from this sort of thing, is not really a thing that we can talk about. Like, the what's been true in the past is not true in this moment necessarily. And so it makes sort of like a question and a change of like the rules of engagement. And when you don't know what the rules of engagement are, you know, you kind of, there's more anxiety of like, oh, are you gonna accidentally get in over your head? Are you gonna find yourself in a place that you're not prepared for? So I definitely think that in that way, this conversation is super timely. In sort of thinking about what does repression look like in this moment. On the other hand, I do think that there's continues to be, if we see Trump's target as not revolutionaries, but as the left, of which he attributes the like radical, like whatever we are, to be like the fringe part of that, then one could argue that, you know, in he's using radical activists and targeting of radical activists as a way to delegitimize his narrative would be like that like going after Antifa, going after these college protesters, that's a way of like delegitimizing the Democratic Party and like the establishment left. I don't know if he'll be successful in that or if that fits in a cohesive way inside the sort of like counterinsurgency legitimacy idea, but it's sort of almost this idea that like he is what is legitimate, right? That like whatever he does is by its nature legitimate. That's sort of like what he's trying to pound into everybody, even though it's in this really like grotesquely simple sort of brutal way.
Yeah, so there are a couple important changes there that you're describing. One is that under the counterinsurgency model, there was an emphasis on drawing distinctions between the parts of resistance movements that could be co-opted or channeled into sort of legalistic frameworks and the parts of resistance movements that were recalcitrant and to some degree illegalist. And those were the parts that would be, you know, singled out for being crushed, right? But part of what made the crushing of the militants seem legitimate was that the model necessarily opened other avenues to express dissent. And, you know, those were by design limited and by design mostly ineffective, right? Like they were very channeled in terms of the effects that they could have. But drawing those distinctions between the violent and the nonviolent parts of the movement, or the militant and the sort of institutional parts of the movement, or the, you know, good protesters and bad protesters, like those distinctions were really important to knowing how to apply the model. Currently, the right, and therefore the government that the right has captured, seem to view all of their opponents as essentially the same thing, right? And so they really don't seem able to distinguish between like the Democratic Party and Black Lives Matter protesters and Antifa militants and like Hamas, right? Like in their mind, these are all a single conspiratorial entity. And that's, for one thing, objectively wrong. But for another thing, a real break from the hard work that the agents of repression have done for about half a century to map out the networks of resistance and understand where the differences lie. The second big change, I think, is that counterinsurgency, though it is a theory of repression and an approach to repression, it has this underlying democratic assumption that the source of legitimacy is essentially the population, and that the thing that is going to make a government stable and successful is being able to gain the consent or at least the acquiescence of the bulk of the people that they're governing. Trump and everyone around him, their approach is to legitimacy is very authoritarian. It is a thing that inheres in seemingly not even the position that he occupies, but just the person of Donald Trump, and then sort of like radiates out from him, which is part of why they're not engaging in legitimacy building in the same way. They're not doing things that are going to, they're not doing things that are going to meet the need of the population and therefore build support for the regime. Instead, they're trying to build legitimacy by neutralizing everyone who they suspect is disloyal, because from their perspective, the source of the legitimacy is the loyalty to the man. And that's a fundamentally different way of, I think, understanding politics, which you may be able to adapt some of the techniques of counterinsurgency to that worldview, but you're going to have a hard time adopting the whole strategy if you have that worldview.
Can you help me understand how the president and the president's approach to power and rule impacts how people should anticipate repression? I'm just thinking about, what does this mean for how local police departments might change their tactics versus federal?
Well, we've certainly seen it matter at the federal level in terms of, who is being investigated by the FBI and the priorities of organizations like the Border Patrol and the targeting the deliberate targeting of protest leaders, but also just like, I don't know, people who have written op-eds for deportation. All of that is like not unprecedented by any means, but it's taken on a new emphasis in just the last few weeks. I think there's a real question as to how local police agencies are going to interact with that. And that's one of the places where I think we're going to see some tension, because the local police are really the place where counterinsurgency has been most consistently applied over the last 50 years. And there has, in many places, been some resistance among police leaders to using the police for immigration enforcement. And the reason for that is pretty straightforward. It's because they know that they need information from the communities where immigrants live. And if people are afraid that anytime they have contact with the police, then someone they know is going to get deported, then people are less likely to willingly engage with contact with the police, which means the police get less information, which means they have less influence in those communities, which then just makes their job harder. It's hard to know how much that sort of practical concern is going to outweigh, let's say, the need for political survival in this situation where the federal government is willing to, starve institutions or geographic areas of resources to punish them for any, sign of noncompliance. It's also hard to know how much the racist and nativist inclinations of the police rank and file are going to exercise some pressure from below to sort of change what has been the common sense among police leaders for, again, decades now. So it's hard to know how the local cops are going to change in relation to the new federal context. But the federal context has definitely shifted.
I would agree with that. And that it's going to also, like, because of some of those different variables, it's going to vary pretty dramatically from place to place. I think that also in places where you have a more like liberal people in charge, liberal government in charge of the police, you're going to be maybe slower to see the full embrace of like MAGA politics. But also, I think we're seeing this total collapse of the establishment left in neoliberalism, where I don't actually trust that any, liberal politician is going to like hold back the MAGA flood by using the police to stop illegal ICE activity. Could you imagine that happening, that any liberal politician would be so bold? That's the sort of thing Trump would do, but that's definitely not the kind of thing that the establishment left is willing to do to fight fight back. And that's why they're getting pummeled. And in some ways, I think that the sort of, in many ways, counterinsurgency is sort of a neoliberal kind of, or like thrives in a sort of like neoliberal sort of like political value set, which, you know, Trump is really trying to pit himself against. And that, like, as an anarchist, I'm not especially interested in upholding either. Lastly, and maybe most directly, you know, in Minneapolis, after the George Floyd uprising, the Department of Justice implemented a consent decree with the Minneapolis Police Department. And that work is being like undone by Trump's Justice Department. And so in that way, I think that those in law enforcement who are interested in acting out in a way that is more in line with Trump's values can know that they have someone at their back, which is just also something that, like, the radical left then has the opposite. We have, when people in the left engage in radical action, you know, Democratic politicians trip over themselves to be the first to condemn it so that they don't look like they're, you know, because they want to look like moderate and appeal to like moderate Republicans. And so, yeah, we can't count on like these neoliberal politicians. And there's a slightly different environment in places where people at least like imagine themselves in some kind of opposition to Trumpism, even if it's not, even if we don't share their values either.
Christian, can you talk more about what this current shift away from counterinsurgency is returning to, and what historical moments we can turn to as useful points of comparison?
I think it's helpful to look back at McCarthyism. There's even a biographical link there, because Joseph McCarthy's right-hand man was a lawyer named Roy Cohn, who was also Donald Trump's lawyer in the 80s and his political mentor. So it makes sense, like, biographically, that we're seeing a return to sort of McCarthyist tactics at this point. But one of the things that people, I think, misunderstand about McCarthyism was that it actually required relatively little of the government. I mean, the House Un-American Activities had some very well-publicized hearings, and Joe McCarthy, like, made some very unhinged speeches, but most of what they did was they relied on other institutions like private companies or universities to do the purging, right? That they expected these nominally independent institutions to carry out their own investigations and to remove people from their positions and to blacklist them from industries. And that those other institutions were with differing levels of enthusiasm willing to go along with that. And I think we've already seen a move in that direction with the pressure that was applied to Columbia University and their willingness to just immediately cave in, not just the policing of student protests and things like that, but also the management of academic departments. And I expect that we will see a lot more of the federal government applying pressure to other institutions and getting them to do the dirty work of pushing people out. And a lot of that is not going to be as overt as it's been in the last little bit, because, you know, it's pretty easy to just quietly remove a person from their job and they don't exactly know why, and it never makes the newspaper, right? Which is most of how McCarthyism works. You know, one thing that we've already seen is a number of institutions complying in advance, right? Like, they anticipate that, I mean, we saw this with hospitals, like Trump sort of gestured toward cutting funding for hospitals that were engaged in gender affirming care, and the and a lot of hospitals just stopped doing it, even though no order had taken effect yet. And the from the hospital administrator's point of view, this makes a certain amount of sense because the risks of losing total funding for what's ultimately a very small part of the operation, you know, it's a very high stakes situation. But the precedent that sets, where it's like that, where they don't even have to make the order, much less actually bring the pressure to bear, and can expect sort of anticipatory obedience, is very bad. And I think risk-averse organizations are going to be prone to doing that, and even to overreacting, over-complying, doing more than would have been demanded of them. And whatever the people who are parts of those institutions can do to prevent that from happening, I think that's going to become an important aspect of resistance, of not just, you know, things like opposing the federal policy, but also bringing pressure to bear on like the local community college to, you know, not get rid of its Black Studies program or whatever. We're not just looking at like one big fight. We're looking at thousands and thousands of little fights in small institutions that again, like, will probably never make the national news.
Okay, so to talk more about how we can be responding to repression as it changes around us, Garrett, do you have any suggestions for how we can build resilience to these kinds of repression that we're seeing in this moment?
Well, when I talk about repression resilience, you know, I'm usually talking about a constellation of tactics that movements use that are less about avoiding repression and more about how we sort of endure it and come out of it stronger on the back end. It can include, you know, minimizing exposure to repression. It can include, you know, increasing your tolerance for repression and how you shape your life. And it can include, most notably and most hopefully, like power building to push back when repression is happening. And the nice thing is that, you know, the things that can help us push back against repression are in many ways the same things that help us be strong as movements in general. And so those things can actually have like a reciprocal relationship. We build movement, we get stronger by building strong connections, strong community, knowing one another, you know, having a clear theory of change, finding ways to bridge difference, finding ways to collaborate to be greater than the sum of our parts, building strong sense of solidarity in a big tent. And then when repression strikes, there's more people there ready to do something about it. And in doing something about it, make movement stronger so that they can win their other goals. And so I guess that would be the first primary thing, is to not think about repression as something else from organizing. That if you're trying to make change, you know, I sometimes say you can't fight the biggest bully on the block and expect not to get knocked around a little bit. And you're not going to go up against the greatest force for violent repression that the world has ever seen and not expect to take some licks. Like, that's just a part of being engaged in revolutionary movement. And so, you know, you have to, if you think about it several moves down the chessboard, you're going to act, the state is going to react to repress you, and they're going to try to control the center of the board. They're going to try to control your realm of possibility. And so each move that we make is about increasing the realm of possibility, increasing our own power, our ability to make change, our ability to resist and be resilient in the face of that repression, and make repressing us less and less desirable. You know, part of the reason I made a life commitment to this work is because I faced repression and I resisted it. And through that, I learned how to push back against repression. And I want to do that for other people as a calling for the rest of my life, so that these people who came after me know that they are going to be continually, till I'm dead, paying, and hopefully long after, paying the price for teaching me about how repression works. And if we all continue to stand together, you know, it's okay to be afraid, especially with uncertainty. It's okay to be afraid of uncertainty, but that, you know, we have to be grounded in the fact that we're trying to do something here. You know, it's not just about, I mean, maybe sometimes when we feel hopeless, it's just about being on the right side of history. But this stage of my life, it's about actually effectuating something. And so, you know, how are we going to do that? How are we going to respond after, you know, three moves down the chessboard when the state responds to us? Because if we're effective, they're going to respond. And so organizing to be strong and be able to withstand that, I think, is, you know, what we need to be thinking about. And I don't have any answers as to exactly how that's going to look. And I certainly don't want to be encouraging sort of like macho, hey, this repression is no big deal. If you're a real revolutionary, you should be willing to endure it kind of attitude either. You know, what I want is for people to be deliberate and, you know, take themselves and their politics seriously and take repression seriously and game out, you know, what are the knowns and how are we going to get through this stuff together? You know, to Christian's point about the sort of like lack of interest in discernment from the state, I think in this moment we see the state attacking a lot of people who like aren't especially radical in their ideas or actions, because they're convenient targets for the state's agenda. And so that's something to keep in mind. Not just to you know, avoid repression, but also why and how we support people when they face it unexpectedly because they didn't think that they were doing anything that would cause repression. And also in this moment, I think we see the George Floyd uprising being a great example, or like Luigi Mangione being another example of like people who aren't necessarily we wouldn't traditionally consider to be like an established part of radical movements. Just people that are fed up with how things are going are like rising up to take action. They don't need they don't need us other anarchists or radical leftists or whatever to tell them how to do it. Actually, in our failure to sort of figure out mechanisms for making change, people are just like fed up and they're lashing out. And so I think part of it is also like trying to figure out how we engage with those sorts of actions as they emerge. Yeah, I don't know if that fully answered your question. You know, in some ways it's we don't know. And we have to be willing to like not know and like know everything that we can and not act foolishly, but act anyway.
Well, one thing Garrett said that really resonated with me was he mentioned about learning how repression worked by being repressed. And I think our whole society is on that same learning curve right now, where I think that there is a common sense liberal assumption that distinguishes whether a person or a movement is going to be repressed is a question of legality, and that you know, legal actions are protected and illegal actions get repressed is sort of the liberal common sense. And I think that we're seeing that presumption just disintegrate in real time, where the fact that something is legal is now very obviously not a thing that is going to protect it. And the truth is that presumption has always been wrong, But the state has usually used it as a way of legitimizing itself. And it's, for the moment, not interested in maintaining any sort of plausible pretext of that, and instead is just really taking the approach of it's illegal because we've decided to repress it rather than the other way around, which I think is confusing for a lot of people, but also disillusioning for them, that they suddenly see what that mechanism is and the very weak guide that the law is for people with power.
In our last few minutes, I wanted to invite any last thoughts.
I think a lot of people are unsure of what to do, and which very much makes sense because the whole context in which we're operating is very chaotic and very hard to predict. And the uncertainty, I think, is part of the point of that. But I think it's important that we not let that paralyze us. I think we need to be able to just sort of like take our best assessment of it and work from that, and then be willing to revise our strategy as it becomes clearer what it is that we're facing, what it is that we can expect. I don't think that this is a moment where we can wait for like total clarity before we can start taking action.
I think that's right on. And I was just thinking about a similar thing for closing out that, you know, I think part of this game theory that Trump is really good at is, you know, just inching along, both flooding the zone and inching along. So not no individual thing feels like it's hard to know if that's the thing to address or not. But that because of people are so worried about it, they're standing poised, they're in a totally reactive mindset. And so people aren't thinking, oh, what do I want to go out and change right now? They're thinking, oh, how am I going to respond to what Trump's doing? What are we going to do to protect ourselves from Trump? And then is Trump ever going to do the thing that like triggers the reaction that means, okay, now we have to go, now we have to do our thing. And so I guess just like encouraging your listeners also to just like be wary of that mindset, that they don't have to hold it all back to wait until Trump like hits a specific tripwire to then engage. You know, figure out proactively how it is that you want to shape the world to be a better place, and get out there and get started doing it, you know, with an eye towards repression and with an eye towards, you know, how it's going to play into this larger stuff. But we don't need to let Trump and his cronies define the terrain of struggle. In fact, we're more likely to win if we can get out of that box and sort of like, you know, get outside of the purely the terrain of struggle that that the far right wants us to be stuck in.
Yeah, we need to, as important as it is to defend when we're being attacked, we also need to take the initiative. We need to have an agenda, have an idea of the better world that we want to see, and do things that will pursue that, force them to respond to us as much as we're responding to them.
Thanks so much for having us on your podcast. This has been great.
Thanks for joining.
Yeah, it was a great conversation.
Today, instead of our usual repression and review segment, I'm going to share a poem from Malik Muhammad, a political prisoner still locked up from the George Floyd uprisings. Malik's bio reads, "My name is Malik Farad Muhammad. I'm a 26-year-old Black Palestinian pansexual Muslim, parentheses, yes, hella confusing, parentheses. I'm an anarchist, anti-fascist, anti-racist abolitionist, parentheses, yes, comma, both cops and prisons, close parentheses, for my love of freedom. My first protest was in high school, a walkout staged after Trayvon Martin's murder. From there, I never really got active again until Bernie or bust, and then, of course, the George Floyd uprising. I traveled the country and organized and fought and was ultimately kidnapped, ransomed, and now held prisoner here at OSP. I have a beautiful son and loving family back home in the Midwest. I'm also a veteran. I was a tanker in the army. And no, I'm not proud that I was part of the murder machine, so don't thank me for my service. I love music more than anything, almost. I'm a guitarist and aspiring pianist, all genres. Not much else to say except that I'm a lover of freedom, equity, and equality, and will fight to my last breath for it. Unlike those who may regret a thing they did to get convicted, or those who tempered their actions for fear of consequences, I regret nothing, if only not doing more before I was caught. I will live for the people, and I'll die for the people, because I love the people. We who want freedom cannot rest till it comes. And now for his poem. What do we do? Where do we go? How do we contend with Kilmar Obrego? Who will be next? Will it be me? Am I soon to be flown out of the town and country? Tell me something. Only silence to the courts. They refuse to contest or retort for fear they get outright rebuked. Then they're exposed. The powerful black robes tumble down in a heap on the ground, exposing the powerless, their authority laid bare for all to see. What is it, made up fan fiction? They have power in any jurisdiction. So what do we do? Where do we go? If we can't rely on public officials, if courts can be hoed while freedom is sold, it calls us to question all we know. The preside, see, questions if the courts have power over thee, to which the courts react timidly, like the big bad bully meeting the other big bad bully. A game of chicken ensues. Who will blink first? Who will lose? I'll tell you what I know. They've lost all control, vying for power at every hour. Oppression is here. That's clear. When they persecuted us in the 60s, you did not listen. COINTELPRO made us the victim. The system targets black, browns, and those from out of Chrysler town and country border, jumping just the latest 2001 expanded state surveillance, foreign wars, tortured souls, waterboards, taken without a word, no due process, no objection, the cost of freedom. See, it's not me. They seek, if you're a law-abiding citizen, you don't have to fear the police. Down on your knees, flat on your tummy, still 12 shots on the back, sleeping in the night, wake with a fright, or not at all. Go for a jog, wrong neighborhood, wrong complexion. I can't breathe. Well, your body's the weapon. Pure conjecture, speak. If you exist black in these streets, you have to fear the police. But you don't see you're immune. Think, they won't come for me. In 5 years, wait and see. When they came for the women, I did not speak, because I was not one. When they came for the queers, I did not fear. When blacks were killed in the streets, it did not bother me. When they deported half my city, I felt, quote, free. When Palestinian lives were demised, I was surprised. When they came for me too, dot, dot, dot. To find out more about Malik or send him a letter, check out malikspeaks.noblogs.org. Thanks for listening to Outlaw. Stay tuned for our next episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Feel free to reach out to us with questions, ideas, topic proposals, or collaboration pitches at outlawpod@proton.me. Finally, thank you to Brass Tapestry for our theme music. Check out the full track, Tortuguita, wherever you get your music.
There are a lot of self-righteous people.